flying saucers are real.
They've seen the aliens buzzing our missile silos.
The UFO phenomenon, either we like it or not, is already very much part of our reality.
That caused a compass needle to spin and spin.
And that's where the whole seed for the idea of underground bases at Dulce was planted.
They have very large eyes, and you know, I found their stare extremely difficult to bear.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Podcast UFO. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We have a great show today. After the news, we have Stanton Friedman coming back as a repeat guest. We're going to be talking about Roswell. We're going to be talking about skeptics and a real good show. Also, a couple of quick announcements. Our forum is very easy to join. We're starting to get some activity. We hope to see you on that. And that's on our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can follow us on Twitter or you can like us on Facebook. And let's roll right into the news. How you doing, Michael?
Good. How are you doing this week?
Great.
All right. The big news is that NASA has finally revealed some Mars rock findings. Tuesday, they had a press conference about the Curiosity rover and confirmed that it has found indications that ancient Mars was once possibly able to support life. Although this is significantly less interesting than many had hoped, it should be remembered that science is inherently cautious, and with something as important with the confirmation of extraterrestrial life, baby steps are really the best we can expect. Read NASA's summary of the results through the link on the show notes.
I personally think, you know, on sort of the conspiracy side of the way of thinking, is that if they found life, they wouldn't tell us immediately anyway. They'd sort of, like, feed us little tidbits like they are on this. I'm not saying that they have found it, but I really actually believe that the Curiosity will find signs of ancient life there. That's my thinking. Hopefully we'll get to know about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It seems like we've had several confirmations that maybe it could have supported life in the past. So this, in a way, seemed kind of anticlimactic, but I think maybe it's also... It could be that it's just establishing the data trail for when they do say, here you go, here is microbe X that we found, and this is why we're sure we didn't drag it along from Earth.
Yeah. Have you noticed the strange rock anomalies in some of the pictures there? There's all kinds of conspiracy going on about that.
Oh yeah, of course. And I love the ones that identify them as things that... Like I think there's one that's a baby shoe. It's like, of all the things to be on Mars, why would a baby shoe be all that's left?
Yeah, that's true. Or how about the door handle? Have you seen that one?
The door handle's good. I don't know.
That's probably from a flying saucer. It's like a flying saucer junkyard. What do you think?
Possibly. Yeah. I would love to find a flying saucer junkyard somewhere.
Yeah, pretty awesome.
Every time they announce something, you know, it's my inner Richard Hoagland is just screaming, just land near the face. Just land near the face.
I know. We want to see what's around that. We were wondering why the orbiter doesn't take some good, really close pictures of that.
Right. Well, you know, conspiracy theorists would tell you that they have plenty of pictures. You just don't get to see them.
That's right.
UFO flap in South Africa. Gert Jordan, director of UFO Research of South Africa, reports a late February spike in UFO sightings near Cape Town. The story has been picked up by news services around the world, and you will find a link to a Washington Times article in the show notes. You'll also find a link to the UFO Research of South Africa website, which has been reporting sightings almost daily on its blog.
Wow, that's something. Are they saying what type of UFOs are seeing?
You know, a few different kinds. They're seeing orbs, they're seeing triangles, you know, I glanced through maybe a month or so and was surprised that, yeah, they really are seeing a lot right now.
Wow, that's amazing.
Meanwhile, Canada no longer investigates UFO sightings. According to a CBC News article, documents obtained through the Access to Information Act, which is the Canadian equivalent of FOIA, suggest that the government no longer investigates UFO sightings. Instead, they pass cases along to a civilian researcher named Chris Rutowski. He, in turn, reports that by the time he is done collating data from 2012, he expects it to be a record year for sightings. You can read the CBC story and visit his website through the links in the show notes.
Speaking of that, we have Chris coming up on the show. He's going to be coming up talking with us in about a couple of months or so. And for those of you who don't, visit our website and check out our upcoming guest page. We have about 20 great guests lined up, including Jerome Clark, Klaus Svahn, who's I recorded with in Sweden already. That's going to be a great show. That's next week. We have Ben Hansen from Factor Fiction. He's going to be on. Grant Cameron, and a whole bunch of great ones. So please check out our website under our upcoming guests.
Russell Crowe's UFO sighting saga continues. Movie star Russell Crowe, who was last seen in The Man with the Iron Fists, recently tweeted pictures of what he believes to have been a UFO outside of his office. While attempting to capture images of fruit bats, he instead got three pictures of a strange light streaking by the camera. Although a sailboat has been suggested as a possible explanation, Crowe retorted that it was too fast to be a boat's mast. Links to the explanation and Crowe's response are in the show notes.
You know, it's amazing how much publicity this is getting. And, you know, this, I think this happened quite a while ago where he took these pictures. It'd be great if a celebrity like him saw a really, really good UFO and took video of it. That would really push some things along, I think.
Well, obviously, the key is we have to get more celebrities interested in filming fruit bats.
That's a good start. I like that, Kay.
I'm sorry, that's just such a stupid story. Russell Crowe. Russian nanosatellite loss highlights space debris danger. Debris from a 2007 Chinese anti-satellite weapon test appears to be responsible for the January destruction of a Russian nanosatellite. The loss of the satellite, which was part of a precision laser ranging project, highlights not only the dangers of the growing field of space junk in orbit around Earth, but the potential unintended consequences of the weaponization of space. The show notes include a link to space.com coverage of the accident.
Now, I wonder if that's like another chihuahua-sized satellite like we were talking about before.
Actually, this one was even smaller in weight than the ones that we talked about launching a couple weeks ago. This one was a sphere, really looked like it was about the size of a bowling ball.
Oh, wow. Boy, you know, the same people that are in charge of the UFO junkyard should get involved with cleaning up some of that space junk.
Yeah, well, you know, in all seriousness, there's something like 6,000 tracked pieces of junk just floating around the planet right now.
Wow.
It really, you know, basically all floating around about, you know, faster than a bullet. It can't be comfortable as you're sitting there in the International Space Station going, I wonder how thick these walls are.
You know, I've always wondered about this. When they are planning, like, any type of, like, SpaceX or anything, any type of launch up through, don't they have to worry about space junk?
They must.
Plotting a course around it somehow?
I mean, you'd think they'd have to because there is just so much of it. It's really getting to be a serious problem. Even scarier is the fact that the Chinese evidently have satellite blowing up technology.
I wonder if the UFOs ever have any issues with our space junk.
I'm pretty sure the UFOs could kick our asses, space junk or not.
You're probably right. Probably just have, like one of those cow catchers on the front of them. Okay.
Exactly. Navigational shields, as Captain Kirk would say. And finally, in last week's news, we mentioned the Out of the World Conference, which is being held today, March 15th, in Edinburgh, Texas. It has since been announced that the conference, which is scheduled to include presentations by today's guest, Stanton Friedman, Travis Walton, Nori Torres, and others, will be streamed live by Jerry Pippen and the Inception Radio Network. If you cannot listen to the entire conference live, it will be rebroadcast this weekend as well. The event is timed to coincide with World Contact Day, which we reported on earlier this week on the website. Inception Radio and the Jerry Pippen Show have broadcast two previous conferences like this, and both times they offered them as podcasts later. There's no word on whether or not that'll happen this time. I was wondering, have you had a chance to listen to any of their conferences before?
No.
Well, that's okay. I was really wondering what you thought of streaming these presentations and, you know, is this going to be the future of UFO conferences?
You know, I think I want to say, unfortunately, it probably is. And, you know, I had a conversation with Klaus Svahn, that's going to be our podcast next week, and about this a little bit, like the attendance of these conferences is going down. A lot of people are turning to this. And I think that, in myself, I think that's kind of sad. You know, it'd be better to have more people actually attend the events. You know, that's just my opinion.
Well, you know, I'll admit I've never been to a UFO conference. But I have been, I am, you know, active in magic, in the field, you know, stage magic. And there is a very large conference that was held the last 3 years called the Essential Magic Conference. And it was streamed live for 3 days every year. And they ran chat while it went. And it brought together some of, you know, the best magicians from all over the world. It was out of Portugal, I believe, every year. You know, some little town, and literally in just like the middle of Portugal. And it's one of the greatest magic events, period, I've ever attended. And it has got me really excited about streaming conferences. But on the other hand, you know, you do definitely miss the ability to exchange ideas. I mean, from the magic conference kind of point of view, you know, you learn as much at 2 a.m. in the hotel bar as you're going to learn in any lecture, mm-hmm. or anything else. And you know, and I guess that's missing from these.
I find that true in any type of conference I've ever been, that it's afterwards, you know, meeting, you know, with people and what you learn. I do agree with you in the sense that it does bring more people worldwide together and more knowledge. So it's a double-edged sword, basically. You get lower attendance, but more attendance, you know, throughout the field. So anyway, all good stuff. Thank you. That's the news today, right?
That is the news today. And have a great show with Stanton. I'm looking forward to listening.
Thanks a lot, Michael. We'll talk to you next week. Stan, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine here in beautiful downtown Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada.
All right. Hey, I want to talk about your recent award that you just received. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to receive accolades from your colleagues and lifetime achievement. You only achieve that when you're old. I've been at it a long time, you know, but yeah, it was nice, and as a matter of fact, I'm waiting for the video. They prepared, would you believe, a kind of 10-minute "This Is Your Life" Stanton Friedman kind of thing.
Nice.
They got some pictures from there was a movie once, Stanton T. Friedman Is Real, by
yes,
Paul Kimball.
I've watched that. Yes,
and it had some, you know, kiddie pictures and so forth. So they had fun with it, and they used that, and then they had me give I gave a response, and I'm waiting for it to appear on YouTube.
Oh, YouTube, that's great. Well, we'll definitely post it on this on our website, and that'll be fun to see that. I was thinking a lot of times, you know, the listeners will contact me and say, okay, stop beating the dead horse, Roswell, but I can't help it. I seem to talk about it a lot. And I wanted to talk to you today about Roswell because you were basically the first researcher there. Is that right?
Well, it's not the question of being there in, like, 1947. Yeah,
right.
I was the first civilian investigator of the Roswell incident. Major Marcel didn't come running to me or anything like that. I didn't get a secret tip. But it's a crazy story. It was totally unexpected. I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to do 3 interviews at a television station for a program I was giving that night at Louisiana State University. We did the first 2. Things went right along. The 3rd reporter wasn't around. Couldn't find her. You know, no cell phones back then. Mm. So the station manager, he wanted to get that interview in, but he knew I had places to go, people to talk to, and so forth. And out of the blue, I mean, he's giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed. And out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. Brilliant investigator that I am. I said, who's he? His next sentence changed my life. He said, oh, he handled wreckage of one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. What? Totally. I dropped my teeth, you might say. I said, what do you know about him? Well, he lives over in Houma, H-O-U-M-A. That didn't tell me anything because I didn't know where HOMA was. It's in Louisiana, and I've been there since to talk to Jesse. And, well, what do you know about him? Also, well, we're ham radio buddies. He's a really good guy. You ought to talk to him. And then the reporter showed up. We did the interview. I was busy the rest of the day. The next day, I was at the airport early, and I called information in HOMA, wherever it was, and got a number for Jesse Marcel and called him. And you see, he's one of the few people that couldn't deny his involvement. His picture was in newspapers, he knew this guy, Bill Allen, the guy at the television station. So he told me his story. He didn't have the exact day, and I shared it with Bill Moore, a colleague with whom I did a lot of investigating at that time. I was at a talk, and I'm giving a talk in Bemidji, Minnesota, and got a second story about a crash saucer in New Mexico. And Bill had a story from the Flying Saucer Review, the English publication from the 50s, in which an English actor, last name was Green, talked about hearing on the radio while driving across New Mexico a story about a crash saucer in New Mexico. His son lived in Canada. Bill talked to him. We got a date first week of July. Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, Periodicals Department. There was a story and confirmed what Jesse had said and gave us a bunch more names. And the next year and a half, we located 62 people in conjunction with the event. The first book came out.
Excuse me. Now, what had you heard about Roswell ahead of that time?
Essentially nothing. There was a short blurb in Frank Edwards' book, Flying Saucer Serious Business, less than half a page, and he got some of the information wrong. And there's a book, The UFO Wave, Ted Blocher wrote, The UFO Wave of the 1947, in which there's about a paragraph devoted to Roswell and all of it wrong. You see, the story, when it came out, appeared in evening papers on July 8th, 1947, from Chicago West. It was too late in the day for the East Coast papers, New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera. By the end of the day, the story had appeared in the Los Angeles paper, Army captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. General says it's radar weather gadget. It's all on the same front page story. And so the guy who put together Ted Blocher hadn't seen the good stories. He'd only seen the cover-up stories. And it lay there until I came along in 78. And so I had no feeling about it, no knowledge about it. I'd noted it in these places, but didn't make, what could you make out of it? There wasn't any information there. Once we started looking, of course, then we went at it hard and heavy. And I must say, I was the first to find Walter Hout, but I found him, I hate to say this, but by accident. I checked editor and publisher, is there a newspaper in Roswell? What did I know? I'd never been there. I've been there many times since, of course. and it listed the Roswell Daily Record, so I called the paper and said, I'd like to talk to the editor from 1947. This is in 78. Oh, long gone. What do you need? Well, I got an article here. A guy named Walter Hout, his name is spelled four different ways in the articles I had. And before I could finish the sentence, she says, oh, his wife works here. What? You don't expect to find, as it turns out, Walter was from Chicago. Yes, he was based in Roswell in 1947. Small town. You don't expect him to be there in 1978, for goodness sakes. So I talked to the wife, talked to Walter. He was a great help over the next umpteen years, 20 years, more than that. He had a base yearbook. He recognized many of the names, helped us out. He was one of the starters of the museum down there. And for many years, his daughter, Julie, ran the museum. She's had health problems since. But so Walter was, you could say, an accidental find. And I should add something else. One of the debunkers said, oh, and I know about that story. Some PR guy made up the story to get attention. I said, you don't even know his name. We were being interviewed at the same time. Well, no. I said, well, I've known him for 20 years. The notion that he made up a story and put it out on his own is utterly absurd. His boss was the commander of the 509th, the most elite military group in the entire world. They dropped the bombs, atomic bombs, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They dropped two more during Operation Crossroads in 1946 in the Pacific. No way in the world he could have put out this story on his own. In addition, Walter wasn't just a PR guy. He was a World War II bombardier. And as a matter of fact, was chosen to drop the weapons, the instrument package, on one of those two blasts in Operation Crossroads. You pick your best people to do that because if the instrument package is in the right place, you've wasted a nuclear bomb, and there weren't many of them around to waste. But, I mean, Walter was very special, and I checked with a lot of people casually in town to get their handle on Walter. I didn't hear one bad word about him. He was very well thought of in town, and, you know, Fredericton, where I live, is a small town, 50,000. Well, Roswell had only half that back then. In small towns, you can't get away with being an idiot or a hoaxer or a liar or so forth. Everybody knows you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I noted that here. I mean, people are friendly in a way that wasn't true in California when I lived out there. You know, so that's how the story got started. Bill Moore and I found 62 people in a year and a half. First book came out in 1980, The Roswell Incident, by Bill Moore and Charles Berlitz. I got part of the royalties. I didn't get the nice comments I was supposed to get, but oh well, I can't take those to the bank, you know. And we continued our research. By 1986, we'd found 92 people.
Hmm.
And my book, I got to tell you a funny story, was Crash at Corona, the U.S. Military Retrieval and Cover-Up of a UFO, the Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident by Don Berliner and myself. And I'm laughing about this because just within the last 2 weeks, I got copies of the republished two-volume Air Force, the Roswell Report. Remember that big one? The first one was Project Mogul, and the second one was Crash Test Dummies.
Right, yeah.
Well, what's funny, they slicked up the covers, glossy, and on top, white large print on red background. New forward by Stanton P. Friedman. Little smaller print. Co-author of Crash at Corona, the U.S. Military Retrieval and Cover-Up of a UFO, the Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident. And would you believe on the cover page, on the bottom, it says the Roswell Report, the second volume, case closed, U.S. Air Force and James McAndrew. Then it says, new foreword by Stanton T. Friedman. And I blast the Air Force in my foreword. I'm waiting for somebody to see this and shriek. Because in both volumes, I blast the Air Force as they deserve.
Yes.
They lied. Yeah. They cheated. You know, and for people who don't know it, this volume, the second volume, this is the one that has the infamous explanation of stories of bodies. Oh, that's because the Air Force was dropping crash test dummies all over the place in New Mexico.
Right.
Now, that sounds...
5 years later, right?
Six. They were dropped 6 years later, and even more important, they show a picture of the guy who was in charge of the program, Raymond Madsen, and another Air Force guy with a dummy in between him. I met with Madsen in person in Albuquerque, and he pointed out that the dummies, for the test to be meaningful, were 6 feet tall and 175 pounds, your prototypical pilot, in other words. And they were in uniform, the way a pilot would be in uniform. You say, why would that be? Because when you're falling with a parachute and you're getting out of an airplane at 40,000 feet, the uniform has a major impact on the heating, the drag, you know, all the rest of that. There's a little problem, for example, how soon do you open your parachute? Because if it's too soon, you're going to freeze to death. So the uniform, what I'm saying is the uniform wasn't window dressing. It was related to the experiment. But and I enjoyed meeting with Madsen. He was very straightforward. He also told me that when he was working at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, he was working on the U-2. And his own boss didn't know what he was working on, borrowed by another outfit. And his boss was going to give him a poor rating. So he had to get the guy that he was doing the work for to talk to the boss. this has to do with compartmentalization of information. And so he and his wife, who also worked at Wright-Patt, both had heard stories of bodies being kept at Wright-Patterson.
Yeah.
So it's a shame the New York Times, which featured this explanation, this ludicrous explanation, on the front page, didn't bother to talk to Colonel Madsen. I didn't have any trouble finding him. And it was very straightforward. In other words, it wasn't a forced interview, and I wasn't pushing him, and we were talking facts to each other. I mean, I stress I'd had a clearance for 14 years and understood how those things work. But, you know, those two volumes, I mean, the first one was the Mogul Balloon explanation, which also doesn't fit at all.
Right.
So I can't wait until the Air Force people see this heading, bright, new forward by Stanton T. Friedman, and then read it. It's over a page long. And I say some very scathing things about the Air Force in Roswell. Mm-hmm. Now, I must admit, now, Cosimo, which puts out these two volumes, also publishes my Roswell book. How's that for a catch?
Huh? Yeah, that's great.
Crash at Corona. Somebody can thumb his nose at the Air Force now.
Now, a couple of skeptics that I've had on this podcast. One of them,
are there skeptics in this world? Gee, I didn't know that.
One was Seth Shostak, who you debated,
yes.
And I heard you did very well with. The other one was Evan Bernstein from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and I asked him the simple question. I said, why on earth would the Army Air Force at the time go ahead and publish that they found a flying saucer? What's your take on that? And, the things that people come up with for a response is pretty baffling. I mean, that alone is the big question.
What did they say? You got to tell me.
Well, he basically said that at the time, flying saucers didn't seem like anything that was dangerous or threatening, and so it was better for them to publish a flying saucer than a Mogul balloon. That was his answer.
Yeah, and that's so much garbage. The Mogul, the newspaper article said, found last week. The last Mogul to be dropped was weeks before that. Utterly ridiculous and out of context because Kenneth Arnold's report was June 24th. And these guys have no understanding of the national security implications. Remember how many sightings? There were over 1,000 in a month and a half time period there. And it was perfectly clear from pilot testimony that these things had hypermaneuverability, could fly circles around anything we had flying. Remember, we hadn't broken the sound barrier yet at that time.
Mm.
And so the government was confronted with a real problem. Who are these guys? What do they want? Where are they from? How do they operate? Are they a threat to us? The bodies were small. Are they connected with the Chinese, maybe? You know, also small bodies. They couldn't possibly go public with the truth. He retired general when I found him, Thomas Jefferson Dubose. He's in those pictures with General Ramey, with Jesse Marcel, with the crummy wreckage on the floor, which has nothing to do with Mogul balloons, believe me. Colonel Dubose, I managed to locate him. I figured he might have been at West Point, so I checked with West Point, and yeah, he was alive, and so I located him. I'm a good detective. He told me in person, and he still was very sharp. He was in his 80s. I shouldn't be so sharp when I'm his age. Just a few years down the stream now. He took the call from General Ramey's boss, General McMullen, giving him three instructions. This is after the press release went out. He said, three orders. Get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it. Send some of that wreckage up here today to Washington with one of your colonel couriers. And I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing, Colonel? No, sir.
Huh.
When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it, especially right after the war, both West Pointers, and they knew each other. So That's an important witness.
Right.
Colonel, retired General Dubose, he set up the Air Force's search and rescue teams. Like I said, he went on to be a general. He knew half the famous pilots you ever heard of. It was a pleasure to be with. And so that's the kind of witness whose testimony you'd like to get.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Colonel Blanchard was dead, and I've had people say he was the base commander. Oh, they must have banished him to Siberia for putting out that stupid story. Well, as it happens, he went on to get 4 more promotions and was a 4-star general.
Wow.
And vice chief of staff of the Air Force when he died of a massive heart attack at the Pentagon in the mid-60s. Big obituary in the New York Times, buried with honors up at the Air Force Academy. And while he was on his way up, he was operations director for the Strategic Air Command, which meant he had thousands of nuclear weapons under his control. Mm. Now, that doesn't sound like an idiot to me, you know?
Not exactly.
I mean, these guys, of course, never dig into the facts like that. We don't want to say anything that might let somebody think this stuff is true. I mean, Seth and I debated on Coast to Coast Radio. We had met we both got a free trip on the Queen Elizabeth II from England to New York, and we each gave 3 lectures, and we each heard the other 3 lectures. In the course of my lecture, I talked about 5 large-scale scientific studies, and after each one, casually asked how many people here have read this, and of course, he hadn't read any. Now, I admit, a year after that, after we had done our debate, I'd sent him a copy of my book, Flying Saucers and Science, at his approval, and he said on Coast to Coast that he had it on his nightstand. Didn't say he'd read it, of course. And the vote after our debate, 3 hours long on Coast to Coast, was I got 57%, he got 33%, and 10% said, I don't know who won.
Huh.
But these guys abide by the 4 basic rules of the nasty, noisy, negativist, the fossilized physicist, ancient academics, what other nice things you want to say. First is, what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell. Second is, don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up. The third is, if you can't attack the data, attack the people, it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
And fourth, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference anyway. So the SETI cultists, and you know that SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, S-E-T-I. The SETI cultists abide by all those rules. I hope someday there'll be a PhD thesis done about the will not to believe on the part of the SETI community. I mean, you can understand it. If aliens are visiting, who needs SETI?
That's right.
Learn sign language.
You're out of a job. Yeah.
Yeah, out of a job. And the notion that somebody else out there, I mean, I agree with the SETI people, there's beings out there, intelligent beings, advanced beings, probably a little more advanced than we are because we haven't had long-distance radio since 1901. They could be a million years ahead of us.
That's right.
Well, why would they be stuck at our level of technology in the mm-hmm. first place? I don't use a slide rule anymore. I mean, maybe they do, but I don't. And why would they send us a message? Hey, SETI guys, we'd like to have dinner with you. Prepare it for 47. We'll be there in 33 years. You know, utterly ridiculous. And the crazy thing is, you think they were living in Disney World or something. They can't imagine why aliens would come here and not want to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, well, why, Stan? Why would they come here? Why don't they just land on the White House lawn? A stupid question. The President of the United States, I mean, I know this is a shock, but doesn't speak for 7 billion Earthlings.
Mm-hmm.
He has trouble speaking for 310 million Americans. Mm-hmm. Why would they come here? Well, I think the first duty of every government is to, you know, provide for the future, security, well-being. And you've got to keep tabs on the primitives in the local neighborhood to make sure they're not a threat to your security. Well, what kind of guys are we Earthlings? Think about it for, you know, 10 seconds. We're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. In the war, World War II, we killed only 50 million of our own kind. Mm-hmm. We destroyed 1,700 cities. Now, would anybody in his right mind out there want us out there? After all, we've given the tip. They know, we know about nuclear energy. And that's a whole new ballgame. We didn't figure out how the sun worked until 1938, theoretically. Mm-hmm. First fission weapon was 1945. First fusion weapon was 1952. Mike released the energy of 10 million tons of TNT. Now, a big bomb that Walter Haut dropped, for example, was a 10-ton blockbuster. We're talking 10 million tons, 8 years later. Mm. In 1960, I worked on the study of fusion propulsion system for deep space travel. Everybody in the universe who was at least at our level of technology is going to know that fusion is how the stars work. They're all like that. It's not an occasional, oh, it works here, but no place else. All the stars we can see work by nuclear fusion. Does anybody think nobody's going to pay attention to that? That's as silly as saying, well, they built atom bombs. They didn't do anything useful with them. Well, tell that to Admiral Rickover. Nuclear submarines go around the world underwater, 1956. And even more shocking, we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for more than 18 years without refueling.
That's amazing.
Think about that for a minute. It is amazing. It truly is. Think of how many ships loaded with diesel fuel it would take if we didn't have nuclear power for those things. And so these guys aren't living in the real world. And they, famous comments by smart astronomers. Governments can't keep secrets. Seth said the proof of that is how badly FEMA behaved with Katrina. The second thing is, look how bad the post office is operating. What the heck has that got to
yeah,
be keeping secrets?
That's really
crazy. And then, you know, we have the head of the Hayden Planetarium, Tyson, Dr. Tyson.
Yep.
He told an audience of 1,800 people. I'm jealous, you see. I don't often get that big an audience. Sometimes. He told them the proof that the government can't keep secrets is how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia.
That's right. I heard him say that. Yeah.
You know, that's a smart remark. That tells you a lot about security. But how about the OSI and the NRO and the CIA and the DIA? You know, these guys just don't live in the real world. So I'd take on any of them. Again, I also took on, it was funnier, Michael Shermer, head of the
boy.
Skeptics Society.
He was a tough one. How'd you do with him?
Or he's I got 80%. I got 80% of the vote. But he started off, made a hole big enough to drive a Mack truck through. He was asked by George Norrie, you know, what's your take on all this? Well, he said UFOs are like those other far-out subjects. There's always a small percentage, 5%, that you can't explain because there isn't enough data. And so that's all the problem is. And, boy, I jumped through that one. I said, look, what you just said is totally false. Project Blue Book Special Report 14, the biggest study ever done for the United States Air Force, mind you, found that 21.5% of the 3,201 cases they looked at couldn't be explained. In the UFO evidence by Richard Hall, 18% of 4,500 cases couldn't be explained. And in that Blue Book, incidentally, that was completely separate from the 9.3% that were listed as insufficient information. The University of Colorado study, according to the largest UFO, not UFO group, the largest group of space scientists, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, they had a UFO subcommittee, and they found that any subject where you get 30% of 117 cases couldn't be explained is worthy of further investigation. So it was downhill from there for Michael, and I got 80% of the vote because he absolutely hadn't done his homework. These guys are not accustomed to having to justify the foolish things they say, and they do say them all the time. Look, I want a date at Oxford University Debating Society. Got 60% of the vote. And, you know, it's not that I'm a great debater. It's that I do my homework. Mm-hmm. Put facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. And these guys never have to do that. I'm just working on my column. I do a monthly column for the Mutual UFO Network in the MUFON Journal. And I'm doing one on press coverage of the subject and pointing out that there is a PhD thesis on just that subject by Dr. Herbert Strentz. This was done at the Medill School of Journalism, Northwestern University. And he later went on, incidentally, to be chairman of the journalism department at Drake University. So he wasn't a lightweight after he got his degree. But in his thesis, he made some, how shall I put this, strong comments. He said, let me get the exact quote. "The coverage has been marked by superficiality, redundancy, silliness, careless reporting, and lack of relevant information. The lack of relevant information was also attributable to the reluctance of the press to ferret out information about the phenomenon and those involved in it." That's pretty strong words in a PhD thesis from a guy at a school of journalism, and who went on to become dean of the School of Journalism at Drake. So what I'm trying to say is we have a long history of nasty, noisy negativists and ancient academics and fossilized physicists saying stupid things about flying saucers. And, you know, if they want to contradict me, show me. You know, put the facts out there. Let me give you another example that illustrates how bad a job the press has done. The largest study ever done for the United States Air Force, Project Blue Book Special Report 14, covered 3,201 reports. That's a lot. This was done way back in 1955. Yet the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald Quarles, said, on the basis of this report, they didn't give the title, because if somebody had said Special Report 14, I'm sure a newsman would have said, what do you mean 14? What happened to 1 through 13? Oh, well, we can't talk about those. Those are classified. Anyway, the Secretary of the Air Force said, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. That's from the Secretary of the Air Force, carried all across the country, October 1955. The only trouble with the remark is the unknowns were 21.5%.
Wow.
That's not close to 3 where I come from anyway. Furthermore, they were completely separate from those 9.3% that were listed as insufficient information. Furthermore, they did a cross comparison in the report between the unknowns and the knowns. They found that the unknowns, less than 1%, probability that the unknowns were just missed knowns. The two groups did not match in any characteristic. And 9.3% were listed as insufficient information, completely separate from the unknowns. So, you know, total lies. But the press didn't report that. And Donald Quarles didn't care. He got away with lying. You know what's even stranger? They didn't put out the title of the report. And they didn't say who did the work. Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, a very well-respected research and development firm. Nowhere mentioned. And so, you know, what do I call it? Dissuasion, lying, call it what you want. Propaganda, nonsense, anything. But these guys that you had on are typical of the crowd that says, we don't need to know anything about this phenomenon. Just quote from these stupid things that other people have said, and we're home free. Well, it doesn't work that way, guys. Some of us want to get our facts straight.
That's right. I did ask Seth if he read Leslie Kane's book, because there was a rumor that he had, and he said to me, well, part of it. So at least he's starting to get through some of the books.
And probably at least the first 3 pages.
Yeah. The foreword, yeah.
It's an excellent book, incidentally.
Yes, I think so, too. Getting back all the way back to what we were talking about earlier in the Air Force's explanation for the crash dummies, I am just wondering why they didn't just plain deny the fact that there was bodies instead of coming up with the crash dummies. What's your take on that, Stan?
Well, we were approaching the 50th anniversary of Roswell, and there was a lot of noise about bodies in Roswell and stuff. So somebody dug out this stuff about the crash test dummies. And look, we've been clever. We looked very hard because we've heard these stories. And look what we found. They used the same map showing all the locations where they dropped crash test dummies all across New Mexico. Three times! Unfortunately, none of the drops were near either of the two crashes, the Corona crash or the Plains of San Augustine crash. They got away with it. You lie because it works.
I believe someone said at one time that there was four lies the government blatantly did about Roswell.
Yes, at least four. I'm waiting for number five. First, they tell us that they lied when they said it was a crash flying saucer. Then they said it was a radar reflector weather balloon combination, as if the head of intelligence for the most elite military group in the world couldn't recognize a weather balloon, which was launched every single day, you understand. The third explanation was the mogul balloon explanation, which they really had to look around to find that one, too. And incidentally, they talked about how classified it was. It was only the mission that was classified. None of the technology was classified.
Right.
Otherwise, they would have had chase planes following every one. They were left to drop in the desert. And the fourth explanation, finally, was the crash test dummy explanation. Mm-hmm. Even though it doesn't fit, you know, it's a history of deception that you'd think our press would have lit upon a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to explain straightforwardly, as I'm doing in this column I'm writing as we speak here. But why do people have asked me, well, why do they lie? Because it works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, is there a better explanation? I don't know. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. That's the rule, one of them.
Exactly. I think the most important question that I'd like to ask you today is, do you think that the Roswell incident is just going to become a total myth as time goes by? What do you think the future is?
No, I'm hoping that there'll be a few more deathbed confessions from people who know the truth and decided, what can they do to me now? You know, we're racing the Undertaker. Most of the witnesses are long gone, of course.
Right.
But there are some long-lived people. I had a note today about somebody's uncle who told him that it was real and so forth. So I'm trying to get to the bottom of that. I don't accept anybody's statement. I got to check. Prove to me he was in the military, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make claims you can't support. So I think also another thing has changed. People are much more ready to believe today that governments might have lied in the past than they were years ago. We trusted mm-hmm. the government. I remember World War II. We just got saved from a terrible fate. If the government said it was so, it was true. Most people don't realize that within 10 days of Pearl Harbor, we had set up a censorship operation. There was somebody who had the right to tell people, you can't say that, you can't say that, you can't say this in a press release, et cetera, et cetera. Honest. So we were ready to go. And I don't blame them. I'm not saying that was bad. Loose lips do sink ships. You know, I remember people saying that. Mm-hmm. But lying has become more of a way of life, and because it works. And so I think there will be a day of reckoning. And you know, I look at the I have to laugh when I think about it. It took years to get copies of 156 National Security Agency UFO documents. Wow, what excitement. And we got to look at them. They were all whited out except for about three sentences per page. They released them. Now, the CIA, much more dynamic, theirs were blacked out except for like eight words per page. Top secret Umbra. Wow. Now, if any darn major media group would show these documents and quote General Bolander, who said that reports of UFOs which could affect national security aren't part of the Blue Book system, that's a direct quote, then any major media group could break the story unless somebody gets to them. Now, you know, people say, oh, come on, you're saying the press was influenced? Well, President Kennedy often commented that they had told the New York Times not to print a story about the Cuba, the Bay of Pigs stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he wished they had, because then he would have avoided the debacle that turned out to be.
Mm.
During World War II, there was a sanction on the use of the word uranium.
Really?
Couldn't use it. Yeah, yeah. And understandably, I mean, you know, you couldn't talk about the balloon bombs, the Fugo balloon bombs that the Japanese were dropping. They would release them off the coast, and the winds would carry them, and they hoped they'd hit in the forest and cause a great fire and so forth. They released a lot of them, but there was you couldn't say anything about what their effect was, so they didn't know whether they were effective or not. One person got killed, incidentally, monkeying with a bomb that was attached to a balloon. But I'm saying censorship was part of the game. Lies were part of the game. Disinformation. It's a fascinating story how we tried to fool, successfully as it happens, Hitler about where we were going to land in the invasion of Europe. People knew it was coming. We landed eventually at the beaches at Normandy, but we did everything possible for the immediately preceding few months to convince Hitler and everybody else that the landing would take place at Calais. We built phony buildings over there to show we were training. You know, a guy, a dead body was placed in the water off Spain with documents in his pocket that an intelligence officer could surmise meant that we'd be landing at Calais instead of at Normandy. And how did it work? Well, the German generals, when we landed at Normandy, bring forward the reserves. We need the reserves. And Hitler said, guys, you've been fooled. They're really going to land over there at Calais. I got to hold back those troops until they land. Then we'll slaughter them. Well, too late, Adolf. Mm-hmm. You got fooled. So, you know, disinformation, misinformation, all those things are part of what happens in the world. It's not only the SETI cultists that get fooled.
Well, Stan, we're out of time. I hope that you'll come back on the show again. It's been real enjoyable speaking with you today.
Well, I appreciate that. I hope people will look at my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, find out about all my books and all the other good stuff going on. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. And again, I want to congratulate you for your recent award.
I was very pleased to get it. Thank you.
That's it for our show this week. Thank you for listening. Remember to check out our forum on our website, podcastufo.com. If you want to contact me, martin@podcastufo.com. Keep your eyes to the sky and check back with us next week. I'm going to go to the hospital.